The energy transition is a long and winding road, and it needs to be taken step by step. Learn more at SiemensEnergy.com.
This is Barron's Live. Each week, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our weekly webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a look at what's ahead this week for investors and a conversation about the real estate market. My guests today are Barron senior writer Nick Jasinski and Jeffrey Kolich, a portfolio manager at Barron Funds. Jeffrey manages the Barron Real Estate Fund. The ticker is BREFX and the Barron Real Estate Income Fund. Listeners to Barron's Live have asked about the real estate market in recent weeks and in a variety of calls, and Jeff is here today to answer your questions. So with that, welcome Jeff and Nick, and thank you for joining me on Barron's Live today.
Thanks, Lauren. Good to be here.
Thank you, Lauren.
So we're going to be talking about real estate most of the day, but I thought we'd start with an update on the broader stock market, which is doing something very unusual this morning. Stocks actually rose slightly in what has been a bad, bad start to the quarter. So, Jeff, I noticed that you offer a market view in your quarterly fund letter, in addition to your views on real estate. So I thought we might start there just with a brief overview of how you see the market stacking up.
Sure. Thank you, Lauren, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. You're exactly right. April has been a tough last few weeks on the heels of some ongoing elevated sticky inflation and a Fed that's indicating that they're going to be on hold for a while. And everyone has seen that rates have backed up a bit. And then, of course, there are accelerating geopolitical tensions, et cetera. So the market's having a little bit of a cooling off period, but you have to put it in perspective that the market's been very strong. The first quarter was very strong, and certainly all of 2023. What I would say specific to real estate, notwithstanding some of the issues that I'm sure many of the people on the call are familiar with, we see a strong backdrop for public real estate securities, both REITs and non-REITs. And we could spend a long time on this, but the 1 or 2 minute synopsis of our view is that much of public real estate has lagged over the last few years for a series of reasons, from COVID to aggressive Fed tightening to this overhang about a commercial real estate crisis narrative, which I'm happy to expand on, which we don't think is going to materialize. And so the stocks have lagged. The stocks are attractively valued. Ultimately, we will get a pivot from the Fed, which historically has been bullish for public real estate. And in turn, we should get a modest decline in rates and tighter credit spreads, and that'll support real estate valuations and reduce some of the weight of debt refinancings. You know, we're going through quarterly earnings right now, and the big picture, which doesn't get a lot of press, is that, you know, business prospects for most categories of commercial real estate still are attractive, notwithstanding some of the challenges in low-quality office buildings, but demand versus supply prospects are attractive. Most balance sheets are in good shape. And again, in our view, the public market has largely discounted a number of the concerns that are out there. So as we look at public real estate looking out over the next 2 to 3 years, we have an optimistic view.
So you mentioned that you would expound on the commercial real estate situation, and that's exactly what I'm going to ask you to do. A number of commentators have felt, more than a number, that we are heading for a crisis given the number of office buildings that are still empty 4 years after COVID. You obviously see something much more upbeat. So explain to us a little bit more what's behind your thinking.
Sure. Thank you for the question, and we're certainly cognizant that the perhaps challenges in the commercial real estate segment broadly, and we don't have our head in the sand as it relates to the reasons to be concerned. We actually spend more time considering and researching what could go wrong rather than right. But simply put, our view, and you're right, Lauren, is that this narrative that's out there about a forthcoming commercial real estate crisis We just don't believe that that's the case. Ever since the failure of Silicon Valley Bank about a year ago in March of 2023, there have been a series of sensationalized reports that a commercial real estate crisis is forthcoming. And when we step back and peel back and think about challenging periods in commercial real estate or residential real estate over the decades, the conditions that would precipitate a crisis just aren't in place. And what I mean by that is, what we look at is, number one, are demand conditions deteriorating in a significant way? And for most of commercial real estate, the answer to that question is no. Yes, there are a few pockets that have some challenges, but when you look across malls, shopping centers, apartments, single-family home rentals, industrial, self-storage facilities, hotels, healthcare-related real estate, most of these businesses have demand conditions that are pretty good. And very importantly, the historical curse of real estate is when it becomes overbuilt and there's too much leverage in the system. And the silver lining that's not talked about much now at all is that there's been very little new construction the last 3 years and very little coming in 24, 25, and 26 because land prices, labor prices, material costs have gone up so much that it's not economical to develop new real estate. And balance sheets are in much better shape. So demand's okay. We don't have excess supply. We don't have over-levered balance sheets. And the valuations are reasonable. Generally, that's supportive of commercial real estate. Now, what's happened is that the challenges of a very small subsegment of commercial real estate, that being the challenges of low-quality, older office buildings, have led many to paint commercial real estate with this broad brush stroke and assume that the challenges of low quality office are representative of all of commercial real estate. And it's just not the case. So the bottom line from our perspective is that these reports of a forthcoming commercial real estate crisis at the end of the day are hyperbole, and we do have a more optimistic outlook on the multi-year prospects.
So we had, you talked earlier about the Fed and the interest rate outlook, and there are a number of questions about what the market will look like if and when the Fed delays rate cuts. So I'm going to go to a listener question from Zung, who says, what are the commercial real estate implications if the Fed were to maintain the current interest rate level until the first quarter of 2025, which I think, as we know, is not out of the question at this point?
Yeah, no, it's a great question and clearly topical and being priced into the market in the month of April. As not just real estate, but the market broadly, the S&P, a number of well-known technology companies that people are aware of, have seen a pretty significant drawdown in the first 3 weeks of April. All things being equal, we absolutely would prefer lower rates. It's beneficial to the consumer. It's beneficial to corporates. It's beneficial to real estate. It obviously is punitive to lower income households and smaller businesses. And yes, real estate is negatively impacted by higher rates. And so, as I said, the market's going through a bit of an adjustment period right now, given this expectation that, who knows, maybe the Fed will delay rate cuts until the first quarter of next year. Let's see. We have a very important economic data point coming out on Friday of this week, which could very quickly change the narrative. A PCE inflationary report, which is the Fed's preferred measure, comes out on Friday. And if that isn't too concerning, all of a sudden some of these concerns overhanging the market could reverse quickly. But, you know, from our perspective, this possibility of the Fed delaying till next year, again, we think a portion of that is already reflected in the market. For example, commercial REITs are down about 10% year to date, and a lot of that has happened in the last 3 weeks because they were effectively flat in the first quarter when this view started to materialize. We think valuations are much more reasonable. And at the end of the day, it's a question of when, not if, because we believe interest rates are already restrictive, at least for the good side of the economy. And so we'll see. Again, real estate has lagged for the last 4 years. We think this concern is getting priced in. We do not anticipate a significant drawdown in public real estate from here because we think that this has already been largely reflected in the share prices. But let's see how things materialize, in particular later this week, if not in the months ahead.
This is a much more optimistic call than I think many people were expecting. Nick, can you give us some estimates on what people are expecting from this inflation indicator?
Sure. It's out on Friday morning. Like Jeffrey mentioned, this is the measure of inflation that the Federal Reserve chooses to focus on, and that's their 2% annual target is based on this index, which is the PCE price index. The headline is expected to be up 2.6% year over year through March, which would be a tenth of a point more than in February, and the core version of the index, which excludes food and energy prices, that's expected to be up 2.7% from a year ago, which would be down from 2.8% in February. So overall, the story remains of inflation progress more or less stalling, kind of moving sideways after significant progress on getting inflation down in the second half of last year. As for the report itself this Friday morning, it's not going to move the market like the March CPI report did 2 weeks ago. Given this data comes out 2 weeks later, it's more or less known what it'll be based on different components of the CPI and PPI reports each month. But anyway, it'll serve as a confirmation that it's been a bumpy start to 2024 on the inflation front and will be the last major data release that officials get a look at before the FOMC meeting next Tuesday and Wednesday.
Jeff mentioned all the people who want to see rates going lower, and I think Jay Powell is one of them, but not going to happen yet. We'll be watching that report, and Nick will be covering it. I had another question for you, Jeff, about the difference between valuations in the public market and the private market in the real estate sector. And we have a question from a listener, William, who wants to know, what is the current premium or discount between private real estate and public real estate? Can you fill us in there?
Hey, Lauren, I'll jump in here while Jeff gets back on. You asked about the broader market before and how that outlook changes given the fewer Fed cuts this year. And, you know, we had this cover story earlier this year where we made the case that for investors at the index level, last year was so much of this the story of a narrow market driven by these seven companies at the top where earnings growth was scarce for most of the index. And you had a lot of multiple expansion and people piling into these narrow themes, mostly centered around AI. In a year where the Fed doesn't cut because of a strong economy, that means more earnings growth for more companies and a broader rally in the market. And I'll just point out, since the S&P 500 peaked in the last week of March, it's down by 5% since then. The equal weighted S&P 500, where each of the 500 companies is worth the same share of the index, is down a little less than 3%. So that thesis of this broadening out of the market, where the average company actually does better than the index as a whole, that has played out. It's only been 3 weeks since the index peaked, but that's been my story this year, and I'm sticking with it. That for the average stock, this is not a bad environment. You'd probably rather an environment in which you have a strong economy and fewer Fed cuts to an environment in which the economy is rolling over, but the Fed cuts a few more times. For the average investor, that's actually something to be happy about. Lauren, I was just going to mention some of the earnings coming up this week. This is one of the biggest weeks of first quarter earnings season. There's, by my count, around 150 individual companies in the S&P 500 are scheduled to report this week. So I'm not going to talk about all 150 of them.
I'm relieved. But,
so I was just going to call out Tesla tomorrow evening, which is going to be one of the most widely followed and covered reports this week. In case any of our listeners are unaware, the shares are down about 40% year to date, and that's based on some concerning delivery numbers for the first quarter, which tend to come out before the earnings results. Those were lower than even the most pessimistic Wall Street analyst estimate. And there are a lot of issues on the fundamental front for Tesla. In China, there's more and more EV producers taking market share from Tesla, who often have cheaper or newer models. And then there's all this distraction from Mr. Musk and his antics where a stock like Tesla, which trades at a insane earnings multiple, a lot of it really has to do in belief of the long-term story. And Mr. Musk has made that a little bit tougher to do this year with some of his comments about requiring a 25% ownership of the company and then threatening to pursue his various AI-related initiatives outside of Tesla. He's in a big fight with a Delaware court over this $50 billion paid package, which I should mention is several times more than the total profit that Tesla has ever made as a company. So I think the focus will really be on the earnings call. We already know that the numbers are going to be pretty ugly, but the pressure is on for Mr. Musk to get the narrative back on track, get
could
people
you
believing in the strategic plan for Tesla.
Could you imagine if this happened at any other big company?
Hard to imagine, but Tesla is not your average big company. I think a lot of will be focused on this, the prospects for the Model 2, which is supposed to be the sub $30,000 model that was rumored to come out in 2025 or so. Some recent reporting has suggested that Tesla is backing off of that program, which is a big deal for a lot of the analysts, where in their models, more than half of the volume growth from Tesla was supposed to come from this new cheaper mass market model. So it really, it changes the thesis. And then more focus on things like the robo-taxi, autonomous self-driving. That's all interesting and exciting, but that's probably more of a 2030 story as opposed to a 2024 or 2025 story. And so it changes the thesis for Tesla. And I think the pressure is on to get that narrative back on track and support a stock that trades where it does.
I guess the question ultimately, Nick, is whether the stock reflects a lot of this disappointing news. And we'll leave that for Al Rood, our Tesla expert, to answer one of these days.
Right.
I know there are two other companies that you want to talk about, so I cede the floor to you again.
Sure. I'll just mention Microsoft on Thursday evening. This is the third quarter of their fiscal 2024, and needless to say, the report will be all about AI. Wall Street is very focused on Microsoft. For the past year, they've been disclosing the percentage of their Azure cloud revenues, which come from AI services. So that's been a big line item that everybody's looking at. That's been growing at a 50% annual rate since last year. Investors want to continue to see that. There's also the AI Copilot assistant, which is part of the Office suite, and any commentary on that will be important. Microsoft is certainly spending a lot. CapEx was up 55% year over year last quarter. It's expected to remain elevated as the company spends to build out its AI infrastructure and products. They also put $10 billion into OpenAI, which is the parent of ChatGPT. So investors want to see that return in the growth and actual revenues coming from stuff that they can attribute to that. The stock is at 36 times forward earnings right now, which is above its long-term average. So again, it's show me time for Microsoft. Alphabet reports the same evening. There'll also be a lot of talk about AI. Meta Platforms is the day before. So I expect to hear a lot about AI midweek. And then I'll just mention quickly at the end of the week on Friday morning, we get both ExxonMobil and Chevron. I don't think we'll hear as much about AI from either of those reports. It'll be about the outlook. Oil prices have rallied a lot since the beginning of this year, both supply side, demand side stuff, and then this geopolitical risk premium from the violence in the Middle East. For all the rumors of oil's demise, it remains a very profitable business at these prices, with oil in the 80-something dollar per barrel range. So we'll want to hear from management of both of those companies what they think oil prices will be for the rest of this year, and how that supports the dividend and buyback plans. And both Exxon and Chevron are in the midst of big acquisitions. There may be some updates on those. I think really this will be about the outlook more than the reported quarter for both of them.
Sounds like a good lineup. I know we're going to be very busy covering earnings this week, and thanks for those summaries, Nick. Jeff, I dropped off the call briefly, so I'm not sure how far you got, but I did want to ask you to talk a little bit about your fund, which is not a typical REIT fund. You invest across the spectrum in real estate, in REITs, travel-related, alternative asset managers, commercial real estate services companies, and so forth. So maybe you could spend a minute or two telling us a bit about the various sectors, and then we'll look at some specific stocks you like.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So my team and I, we've been managing the Barron Real Estate Fund. We're now in our 15th year managing the fund. And Lauren, you're exactly right. It's not a typical public real estate mutual fund. There probably are, I think, about 250 real estate mutual funds in the U.S., and at least 95% of them are effectively identical. They isolate their investments just to traditional bricks and mortar public real estate companies, whether it's office REITs, mall REITs, shopping center REITs, apartment REITs, industrial REITs, self-storage REITs. What they are, they're REIT funds, and REIT funds are dividend-paying vehicles, which have been a huge beneficiary up until 2022 of a 30-year secular decline in interest rates, where interest rates just kept going lower and lower and lower, and there was this insatiable appetite for dividend yield type of products. While 95% of our peers isolate their investments just to REITs, that's not the Barron Real Estate Fund. We research, analyze, and invest in REITs, but in addition to investing in REITs, we invest in many non-REIT real estate-related companies or categories. For example, we invest in compelling hotel C-corps such as Hilton, Marriott, or Hyatt. None of them are REITs. You won't find them in a REIT fund. You may find them in the Barron Real Estate Strategy. We have a long history of investing in real estate casino and gaming companies such as Wynn Resorts or Las Vegas Sands or MGM or Caesars, which again aren't REITs. They're real estate-related companies that are owned in the Barron Real Estate Strategy. You won't find them in REIT funds. Residential real estate has been a multi-year focus for us. I'm not just referring to apartment REITs, for example, but I'm referring to the for sale side of real estate, which aren't REITs. Wonderful home building companies such as Lennar, D.R. Horton, or Toll Brothers, or interesting residential-related building product companies. We invest in the leading commercial real estate service firms in the world, which also aren't REITs, CBRE Group and Jones Lang. What I'm describing here is the Barron Real Estate Fund advocates a broader, a more all-encompassing, a less constrained, a more flexible approach to the evaluation and analysis and investing in real estate. And what I ask rhetorically, I guess, is, well, or maybe I'm jumping the gun here, which is, well, why did you do it this way? If all of your peers, you know, pursued a traditional REIT strategy, why did you come up with a different approach? And we weren't different for the sake of being different. It really boiled down to two key considerations. Number one is, especially for a sector focus fund, we wanted to make sure that this product could stand the test of time. Sometimes sector funds can go out of favor in a very big way for a long period of time, and of course we have no interest in that for our clients. And we devised a product with more flexibility that at least has the adaptability and the potential to perform reasonably well through several different macroeconomic environments. But number two, it ultimately comes down to performance. And we're very competitive folks, as I'm sure many people are in this call. And our view is that if we evaluated real estate with a wider lens and didn't limit our investments just to REITs, but also C-corps, operating companies, commercial, residential, this product should outperform, you know, more traditional REIT funds by a wide margin over a long period of time. And I say this not to be promotional at all. It's just how it's evolved. We're in our 15th year. And I think our first quarter shareholder letter should be up on our website soon. And you'll see that since we launched it, the fund has compounded at over 14% annually, while REIT funds have compounded at 7.8%. And so it should, and if we don't outperform, you should hold us accountable. If we're going to evaluate a larger opportunity set, we should outperform. So that's our product, and one that we're quite optimistic about.
So I had a question. You mentioned all the things you like. What should investors avoid in the real estate sector?
Great question. So areas to avoid, let me give you a few thoughts. I would say on the subsector side, we remain cautious on office, which is well known and has been in the press, you know, weekly since, you know, the last few years, really since the beginning of the pandemic, when people left cities and didn't go to the office and started working remotely. But our view is, again, not to paint all office with a broad brush stroke, because there are some office buildings that are doing, you know, quite well, but generally speaking, there are secular headwinds and perhaps cyclical. What I mean by that is that more and more companies are adopting a more flexible work arrangement, work from home, hybrid work, maybe never have to come to the office, and that absolutely is going to crimp demand on a go-forward basis, and you have, let's say, here in New York where I'm based, you know, most of the buildings are 40 to 50 years old and require hundreds of millions of dollars to refurbish them and provide the right kind of amenities. So we're staying away from office. I would say geographically, we stay away from oversupplied markets. Right now, many of the Sun Belt states have an oversupply condition for multifamily, or we focus on certain geographic markets that may face multifaceted challenges. Unfortunately, on a near-term basis, we're cautious on San Francisco from a real estate perspective. There are affordability challenges. There are businesses and families relocating away. Of course, there are high taxes and other issues. We're always focused on, we stay away from our analysis, we always focus on balance sheets and those real estate companies that have too much leverage, too much floating rate debt, poorly staggered debt maturities. There's a lot that we focus on, but that gives you a little bit of flavor.
Certainly does. Nick, I think you had a question or two.
Sure. I wanted to ask about some different areas. I know Toll Brothers, Lennar, D.R. Horton, those are all relatively large positions in the fund. What's there like about the home builders now?
So the home builders, we think is pretty fascinating in that, you know, who would have thought over the last 4 years into the teeth of a pandemic, mortgage rates going from 3% up to as high as 8%, supply chain challenges where many of the builders couldn't secure materials to build homes, that the for sale housing market would have been one of the bright spots in the economy. And it has really proven its resilience and been a very big surprise for many. We have been consistently bullish on the prospects for, Nick, the companies that you referenced, Lennar and D.R. Horton, which are two of the largest home builders in the country, and Toll Brothers, all of them we own in our fund, by the way. Again, they're not REITs. They're owned in our fund, not in others. We could spend an hour on this, but let me give you the 60 seconds, which is our overriding long-term optimism for residential real estate is that there has been a multi-decade structural shortage of housing in the U.S. I mean, it's pretty staggering. If you think about today in the United States, our country's building around 1.5 million homes and apartments in a given year. That's the same exact number that was built in 1960. Well, way back in 1960, over 60 years ago, there were about 180 million people in the U.S. Today, there's about 340 million or so. So call it there are 150 to 160 more people in the U.S. today. You have to shelter the population. There's a structural shortage of housing, which bodes well for long-term home price appreciation, rental growth, et cetera. That's the comment number one. But then you layer on these secular tailwinds. You know, the work from home dynamic, the ability of individuals to move away from cities now that, you know, many of the corporate headquarters are in the cities, but they're not requiring you to be there, allows more people to live further away from cities. That's good for D.R. Horton, Lennar, Toll Brothers. Number two, many people don't want to move into old homes. You know, the existing homes in our country on average are over 40 years old. And so when a household's getting ready to purchase a home, many prefer, you know, they don't want to move into a home that's 40 years old that might have, you know, leaking pipes or a septic tank that doesn't work or creaky floors, et cetera. Of course, there are some beautiful, charming older homes, but they prefer new. And then lastly is this lock-in effect. And what we mean by that is there's very little competition for the home builders right now, Lennar, D.R. Horton, Toll, because part of their competition historically is the existing home sale market. But with mortgage rates at 7 to 8%, 80% of everyone that owns a home has a mortgage rate and has a mortgage on it, has a mortgage rate below 5%. Mm-hmm. 62% have mortgages below 4%. So if you're in a home and you have a mortgage below 4%, you're reluctant to sell your home and go buy a new one where you're going to have to finance it at 7%. So all of these tailwinds are supporting the housing market. and ultimately is why these stocks have been terrific over the last few years. So a lot we like in the housing market.
Anything else, Nick, before we go on to listener questions?
Sure. Another area that I've written about in the past couple of years has been the self-storage REITs, the public storage, extra space storage, and CubeSmart, I believe, are the three main ones there, which had a great couple of years, but have come in quite a bit lately. I think PSA, let me see, PSA down 16% this month alone. Maybe just quickly from what I've written, from the landlord's perspective, it's an attractive model. It's a storage locker. It doesn't require much in the way of maintenance or operating expenses. People tend to have a way of accumulating more and more and more stuff, not less stuff. And they have a lot of pricing power. You're unlikely to pack up all of your junk in your storage locker and move it to another locker just because you can save $10 a month on your storage space or something like that. So the landlords can tend to raise rents. But the stocks have come in a lot lately. What do you think of that group now?
So big picture, I agree with your comments, Nick, that self-storage real estate is a niche category that long-term is attractive. It requires very little CapEx annually because it's effectively just a box to store things in. And it historically has had some pricing power because there are really 30-day leases. Every 30 days, the landlord has the ability, at least in theory, to increase the rents. And there's been very little new supply the last few years. So long-term, we like them. Near-term, we continue to be cautious, despite the fact that the stocks have come in. The fact that the existing home sale market is frozen is unquestionably a headwind for these businesses. And we track this very closely, and I think you're going to see this when Public Storage and Extra Space and CubeSmart report the results, is that business conditions just are underwhelming now and demand is not rebounding. And you're starting to see a consumer that has begun to push back on these rental increases. And so self-storage benefits from movement. And when you have so little movement, we're at multi-decade lows right now in existing home sales because of this lock-in effect. It's a near-term headwind for self-storage. So long-winded way of saying we remain near-term cautious despite the fact that the stocks are down, but long-term more optimistic. It's an area we're doing work on, but we're not really involved in at this stage.
Fair enough.
I think you're right that movement definitely leads to more use of these facilities. I hadn't thought about it that way, but so true. I had a batch of listener questions that I wanted to pose to you, Jeff. So okay. I'll start with one from Kumar, who wants to know, what do you think of private REITs such as BREIT, that's the Blackstone product, and SREIT, the Starwood Real Estate Income Trust, compared to public REITs? How do you size up the differences?
Thank you, Kumar. It's a great question. We know Blackstone and their BREIT product very well. We know Starwood Capital's SREIT product. Let me begin by saying that we're big fans of Blackstone and Starwood, and we know the management teams there very well. Both of them have created attractive non-traded REIT products in the BREIT product and Barry Sternlicht's SREIT product. They own quality real estate. In the case of BREIT, which gets more press, you know, they've been leaning in and investing into data centers, into residential real estate, historically industrial real estate. They've also moved into student housing. They've purchased a few of the companies that we've owned in our portfolio, a data center company called QTS and a student housing company called American Campus. So we think that they're good products. They've received some negative press, as I'm sure many on the call are aware of, over the last 18 months ago, with the view that the valuations, which are based on appraised values, are stale, that really don't reflect current conditions because it's a semi-private product. And a number of investors have tried to redeem their investments in these companies, but they have challenges doing so. Because they're semi-liquid, you can only redeem 2% in a given month or 5% in a quarter. So it's received some negative press. We think the press is a bit overdone. What I would say, and this isn't to be self-serving, we know these products extremely well. We think they're complementary to what we do. What I would say is public real estate right now is more attractively valued than these private real REIT funds. And if you don't believe me, just listen to, you know, John Gray, the president of Blackstone, or Barry Sternlicht, you know, the head of Starwood. When they go on TV and they're asked, what are the best opportunities in real estate? They are saying the best opportunities are on your computer screen in the public market. Blackstone's been voting with, you know, dollars very recently. Just last week or 2 weeks ago, they made their largest public or largest ever multifamily apartment acquisition ever, a $10 billion acquisition. And what did they do? They could have gone to the private market, but no, they went to the public market because there was a public REIT on sale called Air Communities. And they said, this is just too cheap relative to the private market. Or 2 months ago, and we have big exposure in apartment REITs, just a few months ago, they purchased a single family home rental REIT called Tricon Residential. We own a different company called Invitation Homes. And once again, a view that the public market was on sale. So very often I would say there were public REITs and public real estate is complementary to non-traded. But I would say right now is an unusual period where the public market has more fully discounted the higher rate environment and some of the challenges versus the private real estate transactions, which are based on appraised values and haven't been marked to market.
And I think that's what I was going to ask you when I got cut off before, the difference between private and public valuations. So
yeah, and again, it's not always an either or. It really isn't. There's a case to have to own some public and some private. We could spend a lot of time on that, but I would say this is an unusual period where public, there's effectively an arbitrage, and public real estate is highly discounted versus private. And I just find it very interesting when the largest private equity real estate investors in the world are saying that the best opportunities are in the public market. And so that's a pretty loud stamp of acknowledgement about this opportunity right now.
A great irony, indeed. Yeah. So we had a question from Ali about the tickers of the funds, and I mentioned the BREFX, which is Barron Real Estate Fund, but you also manage a real estate income fund. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the similarities and differences between the two. Randy has asked about that, and give us a ticker for that.
Great, and thank you. So I mentioned at the outset that we manage the Barron Real Estate Fund. We talked about that. The ticker for that is BREFX, which is our Barron Real Estate Fund retail shares. We also have an institutional shares, which is BREIX. That's that real estate related fund, not a REIT fund. We evaluate real estate through a wider lens and really consider for investment, you know, everything across real estate. About 8 years ago, a number of our clients approached us and asked us if we had the capacity and the in-house institutional knowledge to also manage a more traditional income-oriented REIT-like fund. And we, as I said, we research, analyze, and invest in REITs as a portion in our real estate-related fund. And so it was reasonably seamless for us to do so. And we launched the Barron Real Estate Income Fund. We're now in our seventh year managing that. That strategy, its ticker symbol of the retail shares is BRIFX, and the institutional shares is BRIIX. That strategy is more analogous to a traditional REIT fund. It has as its primary investment objective income, but also capital appreciation. And it's almost the mirror image of our other strategy in that the Barron Real Estate Income Fund, the REIT-like fund, typically has at least 75 to 80% of the investments in the fund in REITs, the other 20-25% non-REIT real estate-related companies. And the mirror image of that is the first product that we talked about, the real estate related, which typically has no more than 25 to 30, maybe 35% in REITs, and the other 70, 75% non-REIT real estate related. We sometimes have clients ask us, well, which one do you like better? Which one do you recommend?
How can you judge between your children?
I have four children. You love all equally, I always give the answer to the question. We never dodge a question. The answer to the question is, it really is dependent on what your investment goals are. Is your investment goal for a real estate allocation in your portfolio, is it to maximize returns? Is it to provide some diversification relative to equities and fixed income? Is it you're looking for dividend yield? Is it you're looking for less correlation versus other investment objectives? Tell us what your number one priority is, or if you have one, and we can gear you to which product may be the right one for you. What I would say in a nutshell, if your number one objective is to maximize return over a long period of time, the real estate related fund, which evaluates a larger opportunity set, not just REITs, should outperform the REIT-like fund on a multi-year basis. It won't every year, and it hasn't, but it will have a little bit more annual volatility in the returns because it's a little more equity-like in nature. The REIT-like structure, as it seasons over the next 10 years, has a bit more yield focus, and so it will have a bit less volatility annually, provide a bit more diversification, but the returns will be a little bit less. Our real estate income fund, is off to a reasonable start in our first 6.25 years. It's more than doubled the performance of the REIT index over that time period. And I think some of that has to do with our broader approach and how we evaluate real estate. So anyway, that's a bit on the products, and it's all up on our website, or we could send it over to the folks at Barron's or wherever.
Question, so I wanted to put it to you. We are running over today. I thank you for the explanation. We're running over today, but I just wanted to ask you very, very quickly if you could answer Charles's question, how the 2024 election might affect the real estate market.
Yeah, I mean,
in 60 seconds or less.
I'll try. I mean, the answer is I don't know any better than anyone else on this call. That's certainly a big uncertainty on the back half of this year, and I don't want to make any, comments that are viewed as political. I could make a case that if either candidate ultimately wins, that it could be supportive. I know a number think that if the Republican candidate wins, that could be better for the stock market with lower taxes and lower taxes for corporate America. I'm not sure that ultimately is accurate. I know that happened last time. But a lot has gone well under a Democratic administration as well. Again, I don't want to read in too much into this comment. I don't have a great answer for that. I really don't. There are so many wild cards in and around that, from tariffs to interest rates to Fed policy to where the economy is at this stage. But I would focus on the big picture, which is the bottom line is real estate has been in the eye of a storm the last few years, from the pandemic to higher rates. We think a lot of the concerns have been discounted in the market. We like the setup over the next 2 to 3 years. That doesn't mean that we have the all clear signal today, but if one invests in real estate or in our products, in the months ahead, we think you're going to do quite well over the next few years.
All right. Good question and good answer. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you to Nick for also joining us and sharing your insights today.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners, and apologies again for our little technical problem. Next Monday, in place of Barron's Live, we invite you to join us for a Barron's Roundtable virtual event. This is a virtual live event, Planning for Retirement in a High Inflation Environment. You can register for the event through the link that our producer, Crystal Yee, has put in the chat. I'll be moderating a panel with two market mavens on the best inflation hedges, and my colleague Elizabeth O'Brien will be speaking with retirement planning experts. We hope you'll join the conversation. We're very excited about it. So thanks again, everyone, for tuning in today, and join us next Monday for a Barron's Roundtable virtual live event. See you then.
The energy transition is a long and winding road, and it needs to be taken step by step. Learn more at SiemensEnergy.com.